Hey there, I'm Mark Scarborough, and this is the podcast Walking with Dante, a podcast that has walked way up Mount Purgatory, the second canticle of Dante's masterwork comedy, Purgatorio. We are about to start the second terrace of Purgatory proper, and in order to do that, we're going to do what we always do, which is read through the entire terrace sequence, or the entire sequence of wherever we've been in Purgatorio, in this case, on the second terrace. We're going to read through the whole thing to start us off. I think it's very important in Purgatorio for you to get the lay of the land before we try to figure out what's going on inside the passages. In order to do that, it's important just to have a straight read-through of it. So this is my English translation of Purgatorio, Canto 13, line 1 through 15, line 84. For the first time in Purgatorio, we're going to have a terrace break in the middle of a canto, in the middle of Canto 15. So we have to get all the way to Canto 15, line 84 to complete the second terrace of Purgatorio. You won't find this version of the translation on my website. This is a rough first translation that I've done from the medieval Florentine. I just ask you to sit back and listen to it. It's a little complicated, to say the least. We'll break it down in the episodes ahead. But for now, a read-through of Canto 13, line 1 through Canto 15, line 84 of Dante's Purgatorio. We'd gotten up to the top of the stairway where the mountain that heals all ills is cut away for the second time. There, a terrace runs an arc around the slope as the first terrace, but this one's curvature was tighter. No shade was there, nor even the visible sign of one. The embankment and the path itself seemed to be just the color of the livid rock. "If we stick around here for someone to ask," my poet said, "I'm afraid that perhaps our decision will involve too much dithering." Then he set his eyes directly on the sun. He made his right side the axis of his movements, and he rotated around the mountain with his left side. "O sweet light, in whose faith I enter along a new road," he said, "please lead us along in the way we should be going. You heat the world. You shine above it. If something else doesn't serve as a counterweight, your rays should always offer us guidance." We'd already walked along that terrace for what counts as a mile there at a fairly quick pace, given that our wills were so eager, when flying right in front of us, we sensed, but didn't see, spirits who spoke the courteous invitations to the banquet of love. The first voice blew past us like a wind, "Venus non habent." All the while, the same words were repeated behind us as well. And before it had passed away into silence because of distance, another blew by just as quickly, saying, "I am Orestes." It, too, didn't pause. "Oh," I said, "Father, what are these voices?" And just as I asked, behold, a third one came, saying, "Love those from whom you've had evil." My good master said, "This circle cracks the whip of envy. For that very reason, the ropes of the whip are braided with love. The bridle has to resound with its opposite. I fear that you'll hear, from what I understand, this first bit before you ever come to the pass of pardon. But gaze intently into the air with your eyes. You'll see a bunch of people seated right in front of us. Each one has his back to the cliff." Then, more than at first, I opened my eyes wide. I looked up ahead and saw shades wearing cloaks that weren't very different in color from the rock. And when we'd gone on a little more, I heard them crying out, "Mary, pray for us." They also cried out, "Michael and Peter and all the saints." I don't believe anyone walks along the earth these days who wouldn't have been run through with compassion for what I saw next. To wit, when I got up close to them, I could see their aspect clearly, so much so that my eyes were milked with grief. They seemed to be clothed in cheap haircloth, each one letting another lean against his shoulder. The cliff held them all up together. In the same way, the blind, who have nothing to live on, often stand together at specific locations for alms and beg for what they need, one leaning his head on another. In this way, pity can get telegraphed quickly, not only by the sounds of their words, but by their very appearance, which is just as big a spur toward charity. And as the sun doesn't penetrate into the blind, in like manner, these shades, who I'm talking about now, were not granted the light from heaven. Each one had his eyelids pierced and then sewn shut with iron wire, as we do to a hawk that refuses to remain obedient. It seemed to me, walking on, that I made some sort of transgression just in passing by them. I was seeing them without being seen. For this reason, I turned back to my wise advisor. He knew full well what my mute self wanted to say, and he didn't stick around for me to ask the question, but said, "Speak up! Be brief! Get to the point!" Virgil was coming along beside me on the side of the terrace where one can fall right off, since it isn't engarlanded with any embankment. On my other side were the devout shades, who, through their horrid stitches, eked out tears that bathed their cheeks. I turned to them and began, "O people, secure of seeing the light on high, the one that's the only rationale for your desires, so that grace may quickly wash off the grime that is on your conscience, and so that the river of your mind may make a clear descent through it, let me know, for it would do me some grace and charity, if there's an Italian spirit among you. It's probably best if I learn from that sort." "Oh, my brother, each one of us is a citizen of the one true city, so you want to ask which of us lived in Italy as a pilgrim." I seemed to hear this as a reply a bit ahead of the spot where I was standing, so I forced myself to walk along a bit to find this voice. Among the others, I saw a shade who looked to be waiting for something. If someone were to say, "What's up?" it was already raising its chin up to hear, you know, just like the blind do. I said, "Spirit, you who are taking control of yourself to go up higher, if you're the one who made a response to me, make yourself known by your place and your name." "I was Sienese," she said, "and with these others I now set about to repair my wicked life, weeping to the one who can grant himself to us. I wasn't wise, although Sapia was my name. I made light of the good fortune that came to others, certainly more so than I made of the same stuff that came to me. And unless you somehow believe I'm deceiving you, hear if I was foolish when I tell you how the arc of my years collapsed on top of me. My fellow citizens were joined together with their enemies at the field of Colle. I prayed to God to do what he wanted to do. There our enemies were set to rout. They turned to run away in a hurry. Seeing them chased down in the hunt, I took greater joy in their plight than in any other joy. I turned my bold face upwards and cried out to God, 'Now I'm not afraid of you anymore.' It was just how the blackbird reacts to a little sunlight. I wanted peace with God at the end of my life, but my debt couldn't be canceled by mere penance. Were it not for Pierre, the comb seller, who remembered me in his holy prayers, having such pity from out of his sense of charity. But who are you who ask about our condition and go about with your eyes unsewn, if I've got your condition right? Do I sense that you even breathe as you speak?" "My eyes," I said, "will only be taken from me for a little while because they have offended few by being turned toward envy. I've got a lot more fear pressing down on my soul when it comes to the torments on the terrace below us. Already, that burden down there weighs on me. She said to me, "Who's gotten you this far up here among us if you believe you're going to return to the land of the living?" And I said, "The one who's with me. He doesn't say a word, but I'm alive. So therefore ask me, spirit among the elect, if you wish me to move my mortal feet for you back down there among the living." "Oh, what a strange new thing to hear," she replied. "It's a grand sign that God must love you. Okay, then help me with your prayers from time to time. What's more, I beg you by what you most desire, if you ever cross the ground of Tuscany again, to restore my good reputation among my relatives. You'll see them as some of the vain people who put their hopes in Talamone, and will lose more because of that hope than if they were to go in search of Diana. But the admirals will lose even more. Who's this one who circles our mountain before death has given him the ability to fly, who opens and closes his eyes as he chooses? I don't know who he is, but I know he's not on his own. Go ahead and ask him, since you're closer to him, and speak sweetly to him, since he'll be willing to reply to you." In such a way, two more spirits, the one leaning on the other, were carrying on about me just to my right to broach a conversation with me. They bowed their faces down, and one of them said, "Oh, soul, who's still fitted to your body while making your way up to heaven as an act of charity, console us and tell us where you come from and who you are. For you make us marvel at the grace you receive. It's more than has ever been given out before." And I replied, "Down in the middle of Tuscany, there flows a little stream that's born in Falterona. After 100 miles, it still flows on unabated. From along its banks, I bring my very personhood here. To tell you who I am would be empty words, because my name doesn't resound very much. At least, yet. If I take my understanding to flesh out your meaning as well as I can," replied the one who'd spoken first, "you're talking about the Arno." The other guy said to him, "Why do you try to hide the name of that river in the same way one tries to obscure horrible things?" And the same guy who first got asked that question repaid his conversational debt like this, I don't have a clue. But it's fitting that the name of that valley should perish, for from its start, where the high mountain is so pregnant with water, few others can exceed it, even when Pelorus was broken off from it, right down to the very spot where it restores to the sea the stuff the sky has dried up out of it, in the way that all rivers flow with what's inside them. In that place, the waters flee away from their enemy, virtue, as if it were a snake. Whether through bad influences that arise from the place or because bad habits goad them on to be what they are, the inhabitants of that wretched valley have so changed their natures that Circe might as well be keeping them in her pastures. From among brutish pigs more fit to gorge themselves on acorns than any food designed for human purposes, that river cuts its poor little bed. Then as it makes its way down, it finds wild dogs that snarl more loudly than their abilities justify. The river twists its snout away from them in utter disdain. It keeps cascading down, and the bigger it gets, the more that cursed and sorrowful ditch finds that those dogs have morphed into wolves. Going on down into deep pools, it finds foxes so filled with fraud that they don't worry in the least about being caught. I won't stop talking just because this guy can hear me. It'll do him good if he still takes account of the nature of the true spirit that's unfolding inside me. I see your nephew. He has become a hunter along the banks of that ferocious river. He terrifies everyone. He sells their flesh while they're still alive. Then he kills them off like old cattle. He takes many alive and pushes any prey away from himself, all bloodied He comes out of the sad wood. He leaves it that way for 1,000 years. It won't be reforested to how it once was. As at the announcement of horrible tidings, the face of someone becomes turbulent, as if waiting for something evil to sink its teeth into him from either side. So I saw the other spirit, who had turned to have a listen, become troubled and sad when it had recollected his words into itself. What the other one had said and the sheer countenance of that one made me want to know their names. My request was mixed with prayers. So the spirit who had first spoken to me began by saying, "You wish that I would stoop to do the very thing you won't do for me. But since God wills that the sum of his grace shines through you, well, I won't cheap out. Know that I was Guido del Duca. My blood had so caught fire with envy that if I saw someone starting to get happy, you would have seen my face turn livid. From this sort of straw, I reap what I sowed. Oh, human race, why do you put your heart in the spot where the act of sharing remains forbidden? This one is Rainier. He's the praise and honor of the House of Calboli. No one since has become an heir to his nobility. And it's not only his blood that's fallen fallow between the Po and the mountains, between the sea and the Reno, where good is so needed for truth and enjoyment. That land is so full of venomous thorns in its borders that it's really too late now for any sort of cultivation to root them out. Where is good Lizio? And Harry Minardi? Where's Pierre Traversero and Guido di Carpegna? Oh, people of Romagna, you've turned into bastards. When will a Fabbro get rooted in Bologna again? When will the same happen to a Bernardino di Fosca in Faenza? He was a noble branch from a rather humble plant. Don't be amazed, Tuscan, if I cry when I remember Ugolino d'Azzo and Guido da Prata, who live there among us, or if I cry about Federigo Tignoso and his buddies, the houses of the Traversari and the Anastagi. Both the one and the other are now without heirs. Or if I cry about the ladies and knights, the work and leisure that both love and courtesy made us desire, in that very spot where our hearts have become so wicked. Oh, Bertinoro, why didn't you just disappear now that your own family has vanished, along with many more, so as not to become evil? Bagnacavallo is right when he doesn't have any sons. Castrocaro does ill, and Conio, much worse, both have sons who embody those horrible conditions down there. The Pagani will do well once their personal demon has gone away, but not fast enough that any pure truth will remain among their lot. Oh, Ugolino de Fantolini, your name is at least secure now that there's nobody who could even darken it with further degeneration, but get out of here, Tuscany, for now laments delight me much more than speech, especially since our talk has put my mind in such a straitjacket. We knew that those precious souls could sense that we were walking away. Thus, when they quieted down, we were sure we were on our way forward. When we had gone so far as to be by ourselves, a voice struck us like a flash of lightning that splits the air, saying, "Whoever finds me will kill me." It fled as a thunderclap fades out right after a big cloudburst. When our hearing reached a truce with that first voice, behold a second! With so big a fracas, it seemed like thunder on the heels of a storm. I am Aglauros, who was turned into stone. At that point, to get closer to my poet, I took a step to the right and not forward. When the air was now quiet all around us, he said to me, "That was hard stuff. It should keep everyone in his proper tracks, but you people take the bait so that the old adversary's hook pulls you over to him. Thus, the rain and the lure do you little good. The heavens call and wheel around you, showing you their eternal beauty, yet your eyes are still fixed on the earth. That's why the one who discerns everything still smites you." As when between the end of the third hour and the beginning of the day, there appears a little circle that seems like a spot a little child would play in, just so the sun still seemed to have as much of its path still before it in the course of the evening. It was vespers there and midnight back here. So the sun's rays were hitting us straight on because we'd circled so much of the mountain that we were now walking due west. That's when I felt my forehead bowed down by the brightness more so than in the past. The dazzle of all I didn't know put me in a stupor, so I lifted my hands up above my brow to make a sunshade for my eyes and pare away some of that excessive light. As when from water or a mirror, the light lifts off in the opposite direction, lifting up in a compensatory direction from its descent, as if it moved away from the drop of a stone at an equal angle, as both science and experience shows us. So it seemed to me that the refracted light ahead of me was striking me so hard that my sight tried to flee from it. "What's that, sweet father, from which I don't seem to be able to shield my sight enough to make any difference?" I ask. "It seems to be moving toward us." "Don't be shocked if the members of the family of heaven still blind you," Virgil replied to me. "It's a messenger who comes to invite us to the ascent. In due time, seeing things like this won't be quite so hard on you, but will bring you the pleasure that nature originally intended you to feel." When we reached the blessed angel, he said with a joyful voice, "Enter here on a stairway that's not so steep as the previous ones." We were already climbing, having left him behind, when Beati Misericordes was sung behind us, as well as "Rejoice, those of you who conquer." My master and I were ascending on our own, so I thought, while going on, to get some profit from his words, I turned to him and asked, "What did the spirit from Amanya want to say when he mentioned things both forbidden and shared?" Virgil said to me, "He well knows what harm comes from his great fault. Therefore, don't marvel if he reproaches the likes of us to bring about less weeping for others. Because your desires point themselves toward a spot where sharing seems to lessen the whole, envy pumps the bellows of your sighs. But if the love of the highest sphere bent your desire toward it, you wouldn't have those fears pressed against your chest. For up there, the more who say our, the more good each one possesses. That is to say, the more charity warms its fire in that cloister." So I said, "I'm even hungrier now to be satisfied than if you just stayed silent. I'm gathering more doubts in my head. How can one good be distributed among so many possessors? How can it make them all richer if only a few possess it?" And he replied to me, "Because you're still jamming your mind into the things of this earth. You're still garnishing darkness from light. That infinite and ineffable good which is up there runs toward love, just as a ray of light runs toward a lit up body. As much of the love that it finds, it likewise gives back just as much love, so that however great the love that extends itself, so much more the eternal valor of that goodness grows in it. So when people lean into each other up there, the more there is to love well, the more love, in fact, there is. Like a mirror, each reflects back to each. If my explanation doesn't satisfy you, you'll eventually see Beatrice. She'll take away this and every other quandary you have. Push yourself so that the remaining five wounds, like the first two, will be erased as well, since they heal by hurting." I was about to say to him, "You've given me all I need," that's when I realized we'd come to the next ledge, and my curious eyes made me fall silent. That's the entire bit of the Terrace of Envy. I think it's really important for you to have seen it because it is really complicated. I mean, listen, we're going to get into discussions of proto-capitalism, of the distribution of goods, of how, in fact, distributed goods can be more than the original quantity when it comes, at least, to love, a kind of almost anti-proto-capitalist statement. We're going to have to go through this giant Ubisoft where are so-and-so and where are so-and-so that the souls engage in. We've got three souls here. A female soul, first of all, Sapia. Oh my gosh, we've hit a woman. How long has it been since we've had any woman speak this long to us? And then these two other souls who seem almost gossips in front of Dante and Virgil about the problems of Tuscany and who seem to say, nah, I don't care if they listen to us gripe about Tuscany. It'll just teach them more. And of course, we have a long list of Tuscan figures and figures from central Italy that we have to get through. This is a complicated bit, and this is why people start to balk at Purgatorio, because it does get very localized. Isn't it interesting that the farther we're getting up into the afterlife, the more localized to Italy it's becoming? And we're also starting to hit weird scientific explanations about the reflection of beams of light, how they bounce off at an angle off of a surface, and why that happens. This is all pre-scientific notions. It's Aristotelian, but Dante is starting to drop more and more science into his text, science as he would understand the term. This is going to cause all kinds of problems for us going forward here and going forward. And of course, there is the whole discussion of exactly what is envy and why does envy require that their eyes be sewn shut with iron thread. Oh, gross. Just gross, but also very intriguing, like out of a horror movie. Here, in this part of the redemption of the afterlife, all that lies ahead of us. To get there, you have to subscribe to this podcast. It would be great if you could write it a review, if you could rate it. A review is the best because it helps me out with the analytics. I know that's not your problem, but it is mine in order to keep the podcast going. Thanks for all the contributions you've given to this podcast, not only yourself and your comments and your willingness to listen, but also the monetary contributions you've given that help keep this podcast afloat. I so much appreciate it. It takes just that little bit of the burden off of me as I continue to walk across the afterlife with you, in this case, coming toward the dead middle of comedy. We're almost at the very center of comedy itself. How we have gotten here? Well, it took us a while, but we got here. We're going to come back and look at this Terrace of Envy, at the souls on it. We're going to try to figure out exactly what's going on here, try to unpack the science and also the theology, and lead us out into discussions of why the more you love, the more love there is. I'm Mark Scarborough. I'll see you soon.